Aloha, Jeff Davis, the solar guy here. A breath of fresh air is what you need on your afternoon drive home, not the boring windbags. Can I say that? Tune in Monday through Friday. That's Lies Tomorrow, 5 to 6 p.m., 760 KGU. Aloha.
Welcome to Hawaii's Tomorrow. Coming up today, Jeff meets with newsmakers, shares breaking news, spotlights top community activities and leaders. He'll keep you ahead of the news and informed as you make your way home today. So join Jeff Davis right here, right now, and every day at 5. So stay tuned and you'll have something to talk about over dinner tonight with Hawaii's Tomorrow today. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow today.
Aloha, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal and the program manager for Kosi Island Earth, filling in for Jeff Davis, the solar guy, on this Tuesday, March 19th. Today we are going to discuss an important issue that affects all of us, climate change and sea level rise. Often we look at how this issue affects us in our lives and marine life as a whole, which is extremely important. But today we are also going to explore this viewpoint from a physical oceanographic side. When we conclude the program, we'll talk with a biologist's perspective on how sea level rise is affecting our coral reefs. These are the folks who are doing the monitoring, the modeling, and everything else in between. Here with us today are Drs. Philip Thompson, Samantha Stevenson, Thomas DeClute, and Ku'ule Rogers. We have a jam-packed program for you this evening, so without further ado, we're going to be talking with Dr. Samantha Stevenson, a postdoc at the International Pacific Research Center at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Her research focuses on simulating the El Niño in climate models and understanding how it might respond to future climate change. Samantha, are you with us today?
Yes, hi, Carly. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us. Now, Samantha, where are you calling in from?
I'm actually in Boulder, Colorado right now. I'm out here to do some research.
And how's the weather over there?
Well, it's probably a little colder than it is there, but it's pretty good. Can't complain.
Excellent. Glad to hear that. So I guess, first off, talking about weather, can you explain to our listeners what El Niño is?
Sure. So that's actually my main topic of research. And when you say El Niño, that's actually just one half of an oscillation. It's called the El Niño Southern Oscillation. So what happens is that the Pacific Ocean alternates between being warmer than average and colder than average. So the warm periods, like I said, are called El Niño events, and those are actually named after the Christ child. So this was first noticed by fishermen in Peru because sometimes the ocean got a whole lot warmer than usual around Christmas time, and it was really bad for their fisheries. So later on, we named the cold periods La Niñas to have a little bit more gender equality, I guess. But from a physical perspective, El Niño and La Niñas are created by changes in the trade winds. So something that everybody in Hawaii is really familiar with. So the winds usually blow from east to west, especially near the equator, and sometimes those winds are a little bit weaker than usual. So when that happens, actually the warm water that's stored in the western Pacific under normal conditions is able to slosh a little bit further over to the east. And then that makes the trade winds even weaker and allows the warm water to go even further to the east. And that makes the winds even weaker. So these two things kind of add to each other in a positive feedback. And then you end up with really, really warm ocean conditions in the eastern Pacific, and that's an El Niño. Now, a La Niña is kind of the opposite, right? So the trades are a little bit stronger than average, and that cools off the eastern Pacific, pushes the warm water that's normally in the west even further west, makes the trade stronger and stronger, and then you end up with a La Niña. And then you alternate back and forth, and you have ENSO, or the El Niño Southern Oscillation.
And so how do these weather patterns play into your work and what you do?
Well, I wouldn't call El Niño and La Niña a weather pattern exactly. So that refers to more the pattern of ocean conditions. But they do affect weather patterns in the atmosphere, both in Hawaii and a whole bunch of other places. So one of the things that I'm working on right now is trying to understand how these events affect weather actually where I am right now in the southwestern United States. So the temperature in the Pacific is actually able to create either droughts or flooding events in the western United States. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and what got you inspired to study this topic?
Well, I've been wanting to be a scientist for a long time, and I have a degree in astronomy, and I spent some time doing planetary science, too. And that was really cool, but I realized that when I was doing that work, I was really most excited about reading the news about climate science and about oceanography. And one thing that gets me really excited about it is the idea that I can do science that's really important for all of society. So as we put more and more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and the climate ends up warming, and that's going to be really important for a lot of different problems, societally. So that's what I'm the most excited about from day to day. That's what keeps me going.
Amazing. And do you do a lot of research here in Hawaii as well, or are you mostly focusing your work on the mainland?
No, I do. My main project right now is looking at these droughts in the southwestern U.S., but I'm also interested in just understanding more generally how El Nino and La Nina events work and how they might respond to climate change. So I do a little bit of work on various different projects.
And how do you study the droughts? Like, what information can you pull from those droughts that help you with your research?
Well, we use climate models to do all of this. So these are basically giant computer programs that have all of the physics in the atmosphere and the ocean and that kind of thing inside of them. And what my group is trying to do is to understand, if you have a particular El Nino or La Nina event, does that mean that you're going to get changes in the intensity of drought in the southwest U.S.? So we're designing different modeling experiments to take out the effect of El Nino and La Nina from the atmosphere to see how it responds. And we're actually not seeing that much of a change. So maybe sometimes you can get droughts just randomly. So it's definitely a really interesting question, and we have a lot more work to do to figure everything out.
That's amazing. It sounds super interesting. And you also work with fossilized coral reefs as well, correct?
I do, yeah.
So how does that relate? How do you go from studying droughts and modeling to fossilized coral reefs?
So I think they're connected in the sense that I got interested in droughts because that's something that people see in natural records of past climate. So there's really strong drought events that people see in tree rings, and that's what motivates that study. But corals are another example of that. So basically, you can have all of these archives, so fossil coral or trees or other things that record the climate around them. And what I'm interested in is using those kinds of proxies or natural archives to see how well the models are doing and if there's different processes that we need to get better. So in terms of the fossilized coral reefs, what I try to do is to I try to see whether we can be more specific about how El Nino and La Nina events affect the site of the coral. So I should probably give you a little bit of background on how corals record past El Ninos. So what happens is as the coral reef grows, it incorporates oxygen into its skeleton. But there's two different kinds of oxygen atoms, and they have different weights. Those are the isotopes. And how much of each isotope gets into the coral depends on the temperature. So they can actually tell you something about past ENSO variability, past El Niño and La Niña events. So I'm working on ways to try and get that relationship to be as accurate as possible. So I want to understand not only the temperature effect on the corals, but effects of ocean currents or of rainfall or maybe even of smaller scale effects. So I'm designing other modeling experiments to try to look at that. And the goal is to try to use the corals to understand El Nino and La Nina events and then use that understanding of El Nino and La Nina to try to say something about how that might affect places like the United States, the mainland United States, where a lot of people live.
So who knew when we're snorkeling over those coral reefs, there are actually quite a lot of history in those skeletons that we can extract a lot of information from.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty incredible.
That's fantastic. Well, Samantha, thank you so much for calling in today. We really appreciate you sharing a little bit about your work and wish you the best of luck with your research on the mainland.
All right. Thanks so much for having me and looking forward to talking to you.
Yes. Excellent. Talk to you soon. We'll take a quick traffic break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Philip Thompson.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Watch for intersections without working traffic lights in the Kaka'ako area. Got a power outage there. No problems to the windward side on the H3 or the Likelike. On the Pali, though, we got an accident at Castle Junction. The drive east to Hawaii Kai is fine. No slowdown in Kahala. Going west, the Moanalua is the way to go. It slows by the gardens, but the H1 is really slow. It's stop and go on the airport viaduct and then very slow to Radford Drive.
The sun is the root source of energy in food, fossil fuels, and wind energy. The clearest use of the sun's energy is solar power. BanQu Solar brings to Hawaii a technological breakthrough that maximizes the power from each solar module with our AC Unison system. BanQ Solar's AC Unison modules have microinverters on each module that converts DC electricity to AC electricity, allowing your system to produce 5 to 25% more power than other solar systems. It's cost-effective, has a 25-year warranty and an attractive all-black design. The AUO BenQ Solar Company is one of the most trusted companies in the solar industry. With state and federal incentives in place and utility rates going up, now is the time to generate your own electricity with a beautiful BenQ solar system. It looks great, produces more power than standard solar systems, and saves you money in the process. Call 554-7200 for your local BenQ solar installer and enjoy your savings now.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opili'oahu.com.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian Koa Legacy Tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the Legacy Tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the Whole House Fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. With us now is Dr. Philip Thompson, a researcher associate at the University of Hawaii Sea Level Center. Dr. Thompson completed his PhD at the University of South Florida in 2012, exploring the topic of regional and global sea level. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carly, for having me.
No problem. So, Phil, tell me, what first got you excited about physical oceanography?
Well, I got an undergraduate degree in physics, and that was because I liked to understand how things work. And then I quite honestly wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do with that. So I was working as a maintenance man at a hotel in North Carolina and surfing a lot and generally being a bum. And one day just stumbled across this whole field of physical oceanography on the internet where I could apply my degree in physics to the ocean. And I thought it was a perfect fit for me and my degree and what I'm interested in. So I applied to graduate school and off I went.
Well, we're glad that you switched your career ambitions. The sea level is a super important topic. How do you study sea level changes? What type of equipment do you use to do this?
Well, Carly, there are two primary sources of sea level data that we use. One is tide gauges, which measure water levels locally. And then we also have satellites that measure the height of the sea surface from space as well. And at the University of Hawaii Sea Level Center, we are involved in maintaining a global network of tide gauges, and we use a few different types of instrumentation on those tide gauges. Some of the older gauges, we use floats that just sort of sit on the surface of the water. We measure the distance of those floats moving up and down. We generally enclose them in some sort of enclosure to keep the sloshing about from waves and winds from messing up our measurements. And then we also have some more modern techniques as well, where we use radar and bottom pressure sensors. And we generally like to have about at least two of those instruments there to ensure that if there is a malfunction in one of the instruments that we have something to back it up with. Now, the satellites have been measuring the height of the sea surface since about the early 1990s, and they give us a different sort of information than what we get from tide gauges. Tide gauges give us information about sea level at the coast, but the satellites are able to give us information about the height of the sea surface over the entire open ocean, which is really valuable. So we get spatial patterns of sea level change from satellites, but the tide gauges offer us a longer look. They give us 100 or 150 years of sea level data as opposed to the satellites, which give us closer to a couple decades.
So this equipment is all over the world, correct?
Yes.
And so are there places that are better to collect this information from?
Well, for logistical and historical reasons mostly, the tide gauges are located in regions where there are stable governments, for one, busy ports, which would require a tide gauge. So for this reason, the gauges are largely concentrated in places like Europe and North America, Japan, Australia, for instance. And this is especially true for the oldest records.
And do we have any in Hawaii?
We do. We have a long tide gauge, actually, in Hawaii. It's been operating since the early 20th century.
Oh, fantastic. And so from this information you've been collecting, do you know how much sea level is rising?
Yeah, so if we look at the satellite data that I was just talking about, and we take an average of those measurements over the last 20 years, we can tell that global average sea level has risen about 2.5 to 3 inches during those 2 decades. This is mostly due to the melting of ice on land and also the expansion of the ocean as it warms. And we have measurements, temperature measurements in the ocean and measurements of the thickness of the ice to back that up as well. But what's particularly interesting is that this rise, the global sea level rise, has not occurred equally everywhere. So really the answer to your question of how much is sea level rising, it really depends on the region that you're interested in. And that's one of the most interesting things we've been able to glean from these observations from satellites, is that there are some regions in the ocean where sea level is rising much faster than the global average, but there are also places that are where sea level is actually not rising at all or even falling.
And so where are these regions that are of most concern, or where you're seeing the most sea level rise from your data?
Well, that's an area of interest, of particular interest for me and for my colleagues at the Sea Level Center. We're really focused on the Pacific, as we are located here in Hawaii. And if you look at the Western Pacific, for instance, in places near Guam or Papua New Guinea, the sea level has actually risen about 8 inches to a foot over the last 20 years or so, which is 3 to 5 times what we observe in the global average. Now, in contrast to that, in the eastern Pacific, along the west coast of North America, near places like San Diego in San Francisco. There's actually been very little change in the sea level there over the past two decades. And so part of my work and others at the Sea Level Center is to understand why those regional differences exist and how sea level is changing. And one of the conclusions that we and others have come up with is that these regional differences are largely due to long-term changes in the strength and the patterns of how the wind blows, because how the wind blows affects how the volume of the ocean is distributed around the ocean.
That's really interesting, because you don't really think about the wind having much influence on sea level rise, or at least I didn't before today, so that's a new fact for us. And what about Hawaii? What does your data and models say about us here in the Hawaiian Islands?
Well, that tide gauge that we talked about just a few minutes ago in Hawaii that has data into the early 20th century gives us a good idea of the kind of sea level changes we can expect here in Hawaii. There are, we can observe long-term fluctuations from decade to decade in the sea level, and those are likely due to more of those same wind pattern changes and ocean current changes that we've seen. But there's also an underlying trend, an increasing trend, over the entire record, which is likely more related to the global changes, like melting of ice and warming of the ocean. And in recent decades in particular, actually, Hawaii's sea level is rising at a rate that's very similar to the global average. There doesn't seem to be much influence of these regional changes here in Hawaii. And so in the near future, in the near term, I think we can expect Hawaii sea level to continue to rise at a similar rate as the global average.
So I don't have to start working on growing a mermaid tail just yet.
I don't think so.
And Samantha, who we just talked to, explores how weather affects climate change. Now, you talk a little bit about wind already. Are there other weather patterns that affect the sea level rise that you're looking at?
Well, if you're talking about weather, usually I think of storms when you talk about weather. And actually, any particular storm doesn't actually affect long-term sea level change. But there is a very important interaction between weather and sea level, which is very important. And that's that when a storm passes, it does create storm surge. And those surges of water are actually on top of any sea level rise that's in the long term. And so as sea level continues to increase in the next century or so, the biggest surges, like if you have a seawall, and the surges that top that seawall are going to be more frequent, and as a consequence, you'll have more damage from storm surge. Now, of course, that type of effect is going to be more important where there are many large and powerful storms, such as in the east coast of the United States. That's not quite as much of a problem here in Hawaii.
Excellent. And when you talk about these storm surges, recently heard in the Boston Globe on March 5th, four-star admiral, a commander for the U.S. Pacific Command, when asked what the biggest long-term security threat in the Pacific region was, responded to climate change, and his reason for that was nations displaced by rising sea level. So what would you say about that? How do these typhoons and other types of storms affect your work, if at all?
The work that I'm working on right now actually isn't affected much by the particular weather. We usually average that out because, you know, weather is things that happen over a few days or so. And so what we've been looking at are changes that happen on many years, decades to longer.
Okay, excellent. Well, and is there anything else you want to tell us about your research? Do you have any types of data models or results yet that you'd like to share?
Well, I would like to say a little bit about sea level in the next century.
Yeah.
And how much we know about what we can predict. And we do know that the global average sea level just over in the distant past and also over the last century, that global average sea level tends to change with global average temperature. And so as temperature continues to respond over the next century to the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we do expect global sea level to rise as well. And the information that we have about how much sea level rise we can expect are from climate models, such as the ones that Samantha mentioned. And we can expect from these climate models about 1.5 to 3 feet of sea level rise by 2100, or by the end of the next century.
Wow, that's... I mean, I know that doesn't seem like a lot, but that would definitely influence and impact some of our land, especially here in the islands.
Absolutely. So that would have a big impact on our coastal infrastructure, our beaches, and also the frequency of the coastal flooding events, like I mentioned, with the storms.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Thompson. Your research is really interesting, and I really appreciate you making some time to share your story. We'll continue our chat in a few moments. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors here, R&R Solar and Rolf Chris, Kona Red, Edible Hawaiian Islands, Inter-Island Solar Supply, and Kali Judd.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
In Waikiki, an accident, Talawai Boulevard and Ohua. Also had an accident on the Pali Highway earlier at Castle Junction. That's why it's slower than usual coming out of the tunnels, Kailua bound. No problems on Likelike or the H3. Going west, the H1 is backed up to the airport on-ramp on the viaduct. The Moanalua slows at Fort Shafter Flats. No problems to Hawaii Kai. Watch for malfunctioning traffic lights in Kaka'ako because of a power outage.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
If you're unhappy with the high prices or the way you've been treated by mainland corporations, get rid of them. Let Hank's Tax Service help you. Hank and his employees have been preparing taxes in Hawaii for close to 20 years. The sharpest preparers from Hank's 2 decades of unparalleled tax service have rejoined him to serve you, not make money for a mainland corporation. If you're paying over $200, you're paying way too much. Get rid of that mainland corporation and come to Hank's. Hank's Tax Service, 853-1170. 853-1170.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you, too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
Aloha, this is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. The solar industry has changed enormously in the last 3 years. So many companies have entered the market that one of the most asked questions I hear is, what makes your company different? Solar Services Hawaii has been serving Oahu and neighbor islands for more than 20 years. Solar Services was awarded the best inspection rate statewide from the Hot Water Rebate Program. We were number one. Solar Services is a local family company. We recognize the need for service with Aloha. I personally have given a class for the IRS. I've lectured many, including 2 luncheons with the National Association of Tax Preparers. Roof penetration and tax issues are my focus. For all solar products, meaning hot water, photovoltaic, pool and spa heating, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, you name it. We specialize in photovoltaics and hot water, and of course a free estimate is available. Just call my phone, Jeff Davis the Solar Guy, at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. You have a great day and aloha.
This is Chief Louis Kealoha of the Honolulu Police Department. As part of the HPD's Safer Roads program, our officers are enforcing traffic laws 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But we need your help. A few common sense choices can make a big difference. Stay within posted speed limits, use a hands-free cell phone device when driving, look out for pedestrians, and have a designated driver if you drink. Together, we can make Oahu's road safer and save lives. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis. With us now is Dr. Thomas DeClute, postdoctoral research at the University of Hawaii, working on deep ocean internal waves. Now, we're going to enter some turbulent waters talking with you today. It sounds like really exciting conversation to start at the dinner table. What exactly are deep ocean internal waves? I've never heard of anything like this before.
Well, Carly, most people are unaware of internal waves, even though they're very prominent in both the in the ocean and the atmosphere. And they can really be quite huge. For instance, in the ocean, internal waves can have amplitudes over 100 meters and wavelengths of many, many kilometers. The waves we are most familiar here with in Hawaii are surface gravity waves, like wind chop or the swell when we go surf. And surface gravity waves are oscillations at the surface of the ocean. So if you're able to lift up the surface of the ocean, it will oscillate up and down around its equilibrium position, and it will propagate along the horizontal. Now, the simplest example of an internal wave is something quite similar. So imagine pouring cooking oil, for instance, on top of water. And if you now move the surface between the oil and the water up, it will also oscillate up and down. The only difference with the surface gravity wave is that the frequency of oscillation is now slower, given by the buoyancy frequency, which is determined by the difference in density between the two fluids.
That's how we make lava lamps too, right? Is when we mix the oil and the water.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, the difference, the ocean is something we call a density stratified fluid, which means that the density continuously increases as we go deeper and deeper, mostly due to temperature becoming colder and colder. So you can think of the ocean as made of many, many thin layers of increasing density. So if you now perturb one of those layers, you move it up and down, it will oscillate, as in the case for two layers or at the surface. But now it influences all the layers above and below it too. So the energy of this disturbance not only propagates along the horizontal, but also in the vertical. So internal gravity waves can propagate in all directions, which is a big difference between the kind of waves you know. And as I said before, most people are not aware of these waves, and it's quite understandable because they're very hard to visualize and also to explain. So I've only explained a very small aspect of internal waves.
Can you see these internal waves? Have you ever seen them? Or?
Well, you can see them in observations of velocity or temperature, for instance.
Okay.
And they even do have a surface signature, so we can see internal waves in satellite altimetry data, for instance.
Oh, excellent. And do you use those images in your work?
No, personally, I don't. I'm more interested in one of the bi results of internal waves, which is turbulent mixing, which is what happens when internal waves become large and unstable and overturn. Then they will result in turbulent mixing.
Oh, so what interests you about these deep ocean internal waves or the turbulent mixing that creates them? Is it something physical about it that makes you excited about studying these things, or what really gets you interested in it?
Well, internal waves are very interesting just by their very funny nature. They're very different from the kind of waves, you know. But what interests me most about internal waves is the resulting turbulent mixing when they break. And the reason for that is that turbulence is very important for the thermal structure of the ocean, and also by extension to climate, which maybe we'll talk a little bit later about. So, as I said before, the ocean is continuously stratified, so the density becomes continuously denser and denser as we go towards the deep ocean. Now, that seems like something very normal and that you might not think twice about, but this is actually a very unusual observation and something that we have been struggling to explain for over half a century. And to understand that, we should know something about deep water formation. So at high latitudes, near the pole, occasionally the ocean loses so much heat to the atmosphere that the water at the surface becomes so dense that it sinks straight down to the bottom of the ocean, many kilometers, and then spreads out. Now, this happens at a rate of about 25 to 30 sphere drops, and then one sphere drop is a million cubic meters per second. So to put that in perspective, that's about 200 Amazon rivers that continuously pour down into the deep ocean.
That's a lot of water.
Yeah, and so what is interesting about that is that you would imagine that if there's all this cold, dense water flowing into the deep ocean, you can ask, well, why isn't the deep ocean just filling up with this cold, dense water? And it is not, because we can put a temperature sensor down into the deep ocean and you measure it the continuously stratified fluid.
So it's only in colder waters like the poles. We don't see that here in Hawaii.
No, you see that everywhere. So this water that's sinking at the poles spreads along the seafloor and fills the deep ocean at all latitudes. And the connection between this cold deep water and internal waves is that when the internal waves break, they mix heat down from the surface towards the deep ocean, and they are responsible for creating this stratified fluid that we see.
And so how does climate influence all of this? I mean, we've been talking a lot about sea level and climate change. How does that play into this turbulent mixing?
Well, there's a very important circulation in the ocean called the meridional overturning circulation, which is sometimes known as the conveyor belt. And this conveyor belt is very important for distributing heat from the equator to the poles and for sequestering greenhouse gases. And it's very very well known to be an important aspect of the ocean's role in the Earth's climate. Now, in climate models, turbulent mixing is generally represented by either a single number or a field that doesn't change at all in the horizontal. It's just a very simple representation. But we know that when we go out and observe turbulent mixing in the ocean, it's very spatially variable. It sometimes changes by orders of magnitude, so by factors of 10 to 10,000. And only in the past 15 years or so, we've realized that if you represent turbulent mixing in these climate models as being spatially variable as well, it has a big effect on that meridional overturning circulation and creates different climate simulations, so different results in the climate studies.
So I imagine in order to understand this, I mean, these processes are occurring in fairly remote ocean areas. What kind of instrumentation or process do you use to explore this?
You don't have to go to very remote areas. In fact, Hawaii is one of the best places on Earth to study turbulent mixing. But to study turbulence does require very specialized instrumentation because the mixing, which is the homogenizing of the salinity or the temperature and the dissipation of energy to heat, occurs at the smallest scales of motion, so literally centimeters. To measure something that occurs on scales that are that small requires a very special instrument, which are called microstructure profilers. These have needles at their tip that measure the deformation of the needle due to horizontal currents. And you can measure shear millimeter scales using these instruments, and which you can then relate to the turbulent motion in the water. But these instruments are very rare and very very expensive and difficult to operate, so we have very little data. So to date, there literally is only on the order of 1,000 of these microstructure profiles in the deep ocean available.
And have you been able to work with this instrumentation before?
I've worked quite a bit with the data, and I've been lucky enough to go on a few cruises where people deployed these microstructure profilers. And we have one here at the University of Hawaii. Dr. Glenn Carter has a deep ocean microstructure profiler.
Excellent. Very cool. Mm. So how do other marine organisms and some of the living things get affected by these turbulent mixings or waves? Do you look at that at all in your work?
I personally don't. I focus more on the physics. But one of the by-effects of turbulent mixing is upwelling of water. And so as colder, deeper water is upwelled into the euphotic zone, or the zone where sunlight has an effect, these waters coming from deeper are generally more nutrient-rich. So breaking of internal waves can locally enhance biological productivity. But what I find personally more amazing is that, in general, it's the physics that influences the biology. But in the case of turbulence, we can have the opposite. We can have the biology influencing the physics. So there's some recent work in Saanich Inlet, which is a coastal bay of Canada, and there's a krill that migrates vertically, diurnally, so twice a day. And people were out there to measure turbulence, and twice a day they found turbulence 100 times greater than background levels, but it wasn't due to any breaking of waves or so. It was due to these krill migrating vertically. So actually the temperature structure of that bay was determined in part at least by the biology. That's quite interesting, because if you want to model that, you have to know something about the biology there too.
Awesome. Power krill. I love it. That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Thomas, for being with us here today. Your work's fascinating, and I now can say that I know what turbulent waters really means. Up next will be Dr. Kuule Rogers, who's actually going to be talking to us a little bit about sea level rise and how this is going to affect our coral reefs. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors, Natural Energy Lab, Honolulu Weekly, Sabrina's Restaurant, Hawaii Nanotech, Glass Coating, Focused Energy, and Hawaiian Legacy Hardwares.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No problems going east from town, but in Hawaii Kai, we got an accident on Hawaii Kai Drive at Wailua Street. The Windward Drive is fine on the H3 and the Likelike. On the Poly, it's a little slow after the tunnels because of an earlier accident down at Castle Junction. If you're going west, the H1 slows on the airport viaduct. The Moanalua slows at Moanalua Gardens. If you're coming into town from the west, there's a slowdown on the H1 eastbound by Bishop Museum.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you $100 call-up bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. With us now is Dr. Kuule Rogers, calling in all the way from Coconut Island at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology in Kaneohe Bay. We will actually be broadcasting live from Coconut Island on Tuesday, April 2nd, so stay tuned for that. Kuule, are you on the air with us?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So, Kuule, you've been part of the Coral Reef Ecology Lab at the University of Hawaii since 1993, and you've helped to develop the Coral Reef Assessment and Monitoring Program. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we have sites all over the main Hawaiian islands, and it was the first long-term monitoring program that encompassed the entire state. So we now have 13 years of data, and we look to see if any temporal or spatial changes, so space, changes over space and changes over time. And we do see declines in some areas, and other areas are doing pretty well.
So now, the million-dollar question here, based on today's theme, is how will sea level rise affect Hawaii's coral reefs?
Well, impact on corals will not be from the direct effect of sea level rise, but from the indirect effect. The direct rise of the rate of change is low enough for corals to keep up with the vertical growth, because corals grow very slowly, just about, you know, 2 centimeters a year, but the sea level rise is going to be faster than that. So the problem is that there is going to be a lot of indirect effects. When you have sea level rise, you actually increase the habitat for corals, and you increase the area that they have to settle on if they have stable substrates. But when you have sea level rise, you're going to have changes in freshwater input at the coastal region, because Hawaii has been experiencing statewide declines in rainfall over the past several decades, and this is because of changes in sea surface temperature. And with this reduced precipitation, you're going to have reduced groundwater recharge and stream discharge and subterranean discharge, and that affects the shoreline, because you'll have less water coming in to carry nutrients. and you'll have changes in the coral and fish and the limu or the algae population. But the freshwater input to the coral reefs as it declines will also be supplemented by sea level rise. Because the Guyven-Hertzberg lens, which is our less dense layer of fresh water that floats on the salt water under our islands where we get much of our drinking water from, that will be pushed up as sea level rises. And it will leak out the fresh water above the dense cap rock, and it'll seep out and go into the oceans at the shoreline. So this will override the lower amounts of precipitation coming in from the streams and the subterranean sources. And there will be a species shift in composition because a lot of species are acclimated to certain conditions with fresh water.
That's a good... Sorry, I was going to just stop you there and ask you for a second. That's a really good point. What corals will do better than others? Or are there certain invertebrates or species we find in the coral reef area that will fare better than others?
Corals don't do really well in pure fresh water, but as you go further away from the fresh water, then you see that gradient of corals. But some species of fish, like a holehole and mullet, are associated with fresh water. A lot of the algae, like the limu palahalaha, the sea lettuce, that's associated with fresh water and the nutrients that it gives as well. So you'll see shifts in the distribution and the abundance of the various species. But one of the main things, well, there's several main things, and one will be the flooding from sea level rise, because it's going to be rising in the low level, and it'll back up in the storm drains, and there'll be flooding like you have in the Mapunapuna area right now, where you can have no rain, and at high tide, you still see water in the streets. They've actually seen these baby hammerhead sharks swimming around in the streets that have backed up from the storm drain.
And you're going to have...
Yeah, it's really amazing, but you're going to have more erosional processes and higher storm surf. So this is going to cause a lot of sedimentation, and that's going to be the main issue for corals, because most corals have adapted to tolerate low levels of sedimentation.
So for our listeners out there, what is sedimentation exactly, Ku'ule?
Sedimentation are all of the things that come off of the land. So it would be the dirt and the sand. You know, when it rains really heavy, you often see that brown water that's on the shoreline, and eventually it dissipates after that rain. But it's because of all of the dirt that has gone into the ocean, and it blocks the sunlight for corals, because corals have this tiny single-celled algae called the zooxanthellae, and it's a plant that gives it nutrients so that it can actually survive, and it won't survive without it. And since it's a plant, it needs sunlight. So if you got a lot of sedimentation in the water, that blocks the sun from getting to the corals, and then this algae can't photosynthesize, and they can't provide nutrients for the corals. So that's going to be the main thing. But the sediments also cause physical abrasion, where they just rub against the corals, and they can actually kill them, or they can change their shape or morphology. So instead of having these flat, lobate forms of corals that foster sediment accumulation, they'll be more prone to have these branching vertical shapes that are less prone to sediment retention.
So when we see places like Kaneohe Bay, where Coconut Island is, when that water goes chocolate brown after major storms, that's sort of an example of what the sedimentation looks like.
Yes. And then that sediment, some of it is in the water column and it gets moved out, but others will just settle down, and still others get resuspended, like on South Molokai, where that sediment is picked up every day and resuspended. So there's a constant chronic effect of sedimentation onto the corals there. And the sediment can smother the coral. If it sits on top of it, it prevents oxygen and nutrients from getting to the coral tissues. And then they will completely die after that because of that sediment that's settling on there. They can also affect their spawning pattern because it reduces the light level. So the corals will not be spawning as much. And the coral larvae can't settle on soft substrate like sediment. It can only settle on hard substrate. And when you have that layer of sediment, you won't have these baby corals settling there to making new colonies of the ones that have already died.
And you reference Molokai, but are there other islands that are affected, or are some places in Hawaii more affected than others by this?
Oh, there's a lot of differences between islands. So the extent of sea level rise is going to differ from island to island just because of the varying ages of the underlying volcanic rock and the levels of subsidence. The Big Island is going to see the highest rise, which will be about 1.5 inches per decade. The Maui will be about 1 inch per decade, and Oahu and Kauai about 0.6, so not quite half, a little more than 0.5 inches per decade. But the northwestern Hawaiian islands, Papahanao, Mokuakea, is going to be severely affected because they support the largest tropical seabird rookery in the world. They have breeding habitats for seabirds, endemic land birds, foraging, breeding, haul-out areas for the endangered monk seal and the green sea turtle. And sea level rise will threaten these breeding areas with a combined effect of sea level rise and higher waves. And those rising sea levels may inundate low-lying areas across the globe, placing island biodiversity at risk. So you have different compositions of species and less species. And one of the most dramatic illustrations of this, how global warming can affect Earth species and their habitat, is Whalesgate Island in the French Frigate Shoal in northwestern Hawaiian Island. It was only about 10 to 15 acres in size, and it was covered with vegetation, but it had seabirds, monk seals, turtles laying eggs. It no longer exists. That island, in the course of the last 20 years, has completely disappeared with sea level rise. And it's happening at such elevated rates that it defies evolution and adaptation for most species. But different areas will be affected differently in the main Hawaiian islands. Our Coral Reef Assessment and Monitoring Program examined the entire Ahupua'as, looking at that connection from the Mauka to the Makai components, that whole ridge-to-reef paradigm. And we found that some areas will be more affected than others. It seems that the shallow south shore environment will be the most affected. As you go around each of the islands to the east and the west, it's not as affected. And then there's no statistically significant link at all for the north-facing shores that are exposed to this persistent high surf. So as you know, on the north shores of the island, this material that's coming off from the watershed, like the sediment, can be picked up and taken off of the coral, so that it doesn't have as much impact as it has in the south shore environment. But, like on Oahu, that's where most of the nice beaches are, that's where most of the hotels are, this is where most of the homes and the large areas are that have been developed. So these areas are going to be heavily affected. And we know that Hawaii's economy is based on tourism.
Sorry, Kule, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running short on time. But, I mean, your work is so important and so fascinating because not a lot of people are looking at these specific areas and our shorelines and coral reefs here in Hawaii, which are so important. So thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us about your work.
Okay, well, thank you very much for doing programs like this. We definitely need it.
Thank you. I'd like to take some time to just thank, first of all, Jeff Davis, a special thanks to him, Kosi Island Earth and the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, and a special thank you to our guest today who could talk to us about sea level rise from the physical to the biological and everything in between. I'd also like to thank some of our sponsors, Tom Moffitt Productions, Island Cooling, UH Federal Credit Union, the Manila Hotel, D.R. Houghton Schuler Homes, Solar Services Hawaii, Young Brothers, and Green Sun Hawaii. I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.